on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Welcome aboard the Gudu, the mighty inland fish of the Dreamtime, the Murray Cod, the fish of legend, one of the world's greatest freshwater fish, a big fish, a beautiful fish, a fish that was headed for extinction until people like our first guest on The Big Fish and the anglers of the inland turned things around. It's our first cast this morning on The Big Fish. Stuart Rowland is no stranger to the Big Fish audience. A wonderful series on the Big Fish, which is still there on the podcast too if you want to look it up. Know Your Natives, where we looked at all of the different wonderful freshwater native fish of Australia. And Stu spent his life trying to save them, particularly the mighty Murray cod and the eastern cod. And Stu has written a fascinating book. It's called The Codfather. And Stuart Rowland joins us on the line from his beautiful home up there in the far north of the state. Good morning, Stu.
Yeah, good morning, Scott. How are you? Good to catch up with you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Well done for getting this book out. It's a wonderful modern history of the Murray cod. But let's start at the start. Your interest in this really piqued by a family tradition of catching Murray cod in the old days. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Scott. I was born into what I think is a typical Aussie family. You know, my ancestors came out from Wales and Ireland, England, and so on in the mid to late 1800s. And my great-grandfather owned some farms just out of Tamworth near Moore Creek and the Tunga on the Pearl River. And then after the First World War, they were sold up through family inheritance and so on. And my grandfather bought a farm on the Pearl. So the Rowlands have owned farms on the Pearl River from the late 1800s through to the the mid 1900s, and a great link with Murray cod, because the scientific name of Murray cod is today Maculicella pili. It was named pili by the explorer Major Mitchell in 1831, and Mitchell camped on the Pearl River just downstream of the current site of Tamworth. And just upstream from where the Rowlands owned their various farms in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So the link to Murray cod goes way back to when it was first named, really.
And we're jumping forward a bit, and we'll cover this in more depth.
Yep.
But there's another species of Murray cod in the eastern flowing streams. And talking about names, Isaac, your grandfather... and it's not usually the done thing in scientific circles, but you've snuck a tribute to the old bloke in there, haven't you? It's a great story.
Yeah, I did, Scott. And my research career really on freshwater fish started in 1978, and I was asked to look at the biology and breeding, artificial breeding of Murray cod. And when I started to look at the history, we realised there was some populations of freshwater cod in the eastern coastal drainages, such as the Clarence River and the Richmond River and the Brisbane River. And when I looked closely at it, by the time I started my work, cod had disappeared from the Brisbane and the Richmond River and other rivers like the Logan and so on. So they'd become extinct there. But there was a small number of cod in the Clarence River and in the Mary River system. And so using a number of techniques, I determined that the cod in the Clarence River was actually a separate species to Murray cod. There'd always been doubt as to its taxonomic status. So were they stock Murray cod? Were they Murray cod that just existed in the eastern drainages? Or were they an endemic separate species? And they actually turned out to be the latter, genetically distinct. Well, it wouldn't interbreed. And so it was really a new species to science. And in 1985, I actually named the species, because I was the person who did that work. I named it Maculicella ikei after my wonderful grandfather, Ike Rowland.
It's a great story. And look, we'll cover that story in greater depth when we get to, and we'll serialise this once again, as we did with Know Your Natives, because it's such good fun to hear from a scientist who's dedicated his life really to these wonderful fish that we love and now protect so much. But in the day, Ike didn't, but he was like many farmers. They needed a feed of fish. And they found a feed of fish in the river. And there's a classic photo of Isaac and his mate Gus Yates.
Gus Yates, yes, that's right. Yeah.
with a big stringer of big Murray cod. It makes you, if you saw that today, your blood would boil. But that was what they did in those days to get a fresh feed of fish.
Yeah, my grandfather was a great fisherman, just lived on the river, loved fish. He was just a keen shooter and fisher and so on, but loved Murray cod. And of course, he saw nearly the disappearance of Murray cod from the Peel River. So the river, you know, where the type species was, they basically disappeared from there during Ike's life. They were still found down in the Namoi in the bottom end of the Peel and so on, but not around the Upper Peel and where Ike lived, around Tamworth. And so Ike and Gus and others used to travel to catch their cod, sometimes to the Namoi, but often further to the Barwon and the McIntyre River and so on. And so that photo in the book, Scott, is of a string of cod caught in the Barwon River in 1962, and indicating that at that stage the stocks were still really healthy in rivers like the Barwon and the Darling and so on. And it's interesting, Scott, that even though they caught a lot of cod, my grandfather had seen the cod decline in the Peel, and so he was very conscious that, you know, of looking after the fish. And so when they went on their trips, they would only take fish that satisfied the demands of, say, the family and the neighbours and the relatives. And so, well, there's a few of them, and they caught a few fish. But they would tether them up during their fishing trips. And at the end of the trip, they would then, kill the cod they were keeping. But they would let cod go that they didn't really need if they caught a heap.
Wow, so they really tied them up like tame horses.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they put just a string through the gills, or actually through the bottom jaw, and then made sure they put the cod in a place where the cod felt comfortable, like alongside a log or a bank, and they would leave them there. And so that when they broke camp, you know, a few days later or a week later, they, you know, the fish would be really fresh for their journey home to Tamworth. And so, but it was interesting that he was concerned about, you know, the future of cod back in those days in the 50s and 60s, and with a form of catch and release even then, to people like him that were aware of the species.
Yeah, and of course there were commercial fisheries with net fisheries on the Murray-Darling system where they were taking hundreds and hundreds of tons of these fish before the degradation and regulation of the rivers, before the introduction of pest species like carp and redfin. You know, the amateurs weren't doing as much as the pros, who I think still might play their trade in some places, or maybe not anymore, but they would have certainly during your time. We're speaking with Stuart Rowland, who's written the book The Codfather, a life dedicated to the study and conservation of Australian freshwater fish, particularly the mighty Murray cod and the eastern cod. And what are some of the recollections as a young bloke with your dad or with granddad Ike out in the bush catching cod or shooting? I mean, I guess that was how you survived on the Peel back in those days.
Yeah, it was. And you know, Dad would often be asked by his mum, my wonderful grandmother, to go and catch a couple of yellowbelly, you know, of an afternoon for dinner that night. And so there was still plenty of yellowbelly and catfish around, but fish like Murray cod and bony bream that had been really common they basically disappeared. Silver perch were basically gone from rivers where they did once exist. But yeah, the fish were still reasonably common, and Dad was a keen fisherman too. So I learned a lot about fishing and about the inland rivers and the inland fish from Dad and from my grandfather. And one of the things I learned was this fascination of Murray cod, and that it was the fish and it was a special fish. I saw my first cod I was probably about 10 years of age, I think, 9 or 10, and I went fishing with my grandfather. We lived at Wagga at the time, but he would take me fishing when we were up there with holidays. And we just went out to the river and set a few lines, as you did in those days, drank directly from the river. This was the Namoi River, and the water was beautiful and clean most of the time then, unless it had been rain or fresh or a flood. And I remember that my grandfather was using a bird as a bait, and he caught this beautiful cod, probably about, if I recall, about 5 kilos with the old 10 pounds. So, and you could see it 2 metres down in the water after it had taken the bait, and he pulled it up. And he was a very quiet, humble man, but he just had this, he was just this beautiful smile and proud smile. And then when we took it home and Grandma saw it, well, it was really a realisation to me that this fish was something special.
And a fresh feed of fish for people in the bush. I mean, freshness is everything, as we know. You know, that's really important, and they knew how to treat it as well. But as a little kid, you know, to see such, and that was only a small one, but there's even the small ones are big, as you know, Stu. I mean, that would have been indelibly printed on your brain, you know, because they are bloody big.
And my grandfather told me the story about a monster cod. So he grew up at Tamworth, spent all his life there, but some of his friends about his age, they went up and started farming in the areas around Walgett and areas on the Barwon and the McIntyre. So that's why Pa used to often go up there fishing, because he had friends. But anyway, there was this story that he used to recall to me every time we went fishing, just about this monster cod that had been caught in the Barwon River in the early 1900s, 1902. And the story goes that there was two railway workers camped out on the river, and the river was low, and they could hear this huge cod rolling on the surface of the night. So they made up some heavy gear and shot a kangaroo and used some kangaroo meat, and they caught this cod that was absolutely huge. It was actually 250 pounds.
Holy moly.
And it was such an exceptional fish that it was displayed in a marquee in Walgett, and people were charged to enter the marquee and have a look at this cod hanging up. And the proceeds went to the Walgett District Hospital.
Oh.
And so it's a really authenticated story. I've heard it from a few old timers. My grandfather used to, tell me about it all the time. And unfortunately, the historical records, the written records, I'm not sure whether there was even a photo, were lost when the copies of the Walgett Spectator were actually burnt. The archival copies were burnt in a fire in the 1930s. So unfortunately, it was lost. But these stories, anecdotal stories and historical stories, are so important.
What a good story.
Role. It is a great story, yeah. And so my grandfather was not prone to exaggeration.
No, it was true. It was true. Yeah, 250 pounds.
Yeah, 250 pounds. So the old about 113 kilos.
And that's feasible, isn't it?
That is, Scott. Back in the days, and what you get with most fish species and fisheries, that early in their exploitation, you get a lot of exceptionally big fish. And then when they're fished reasonably heavily, the big fish tend to get lost. They get caught first, or they die or whatever through natural mortality. And so they're gone after a while. But there's many, many records from old commercial fishermen, old river people, of cod, you know, very common around the 50 kilos. So the old 100 pound, they were just really common to the inland fishermen.
And I've heard a story about that one at Walgett, that the two railway fettlers, it was a set line. They tied it to a bend in the railway track.
Yep.
And then when they came back, it was a straight section of rail.
That
the cod had straightened it out. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. And look, there's another.
But it's a fish of legend, isn't it? Yeah, it's a fish of legend.
Well, Dame Mary Gilmore, who was probably one of our great historians, and probably one of the really first white conservationists, she had a lot to do with Aborigines and so on, but she reported a fish that was killed in the Murrumbidgee near Wagga during a bit of a flood. And like, this fish was so big that, you know, it was estimated to be over 300 pounds. And two men, they pulled it out of the water, it was dead, onto a sandbank. And then they put its head on a stump, and it remained there for years. So there's Dame Mary sort of had that story from a huge cod down in the Murrumbidgee River. And that was in the early 1900s. So,
yeah. Look, we'll get you back, and we're going to continue to look at this definitive book about the modern history and the history of the cod, because, as you said, Ike started to see that decline. You saw the decline. And then, with the help of science, we've been able to turn things around. So this is a story with a pretty optimistic ending. So we'll come back to a young biologist who's all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, ready to make a difference in the world and save a fish species.
All right, lovely. Looking forward to it, Scott. Thanks, mate.
So am I, Stu. Stu Rowland, thanks for joining us, author of The Codfather, a brand-new book that's out now on the history of the mighty Murray cod, or gudu, as the Aboriginal people called it. Coming up next on The Big Fish, a song that could save your life. With the nature of fishing, of course, it's on the water, near the water, in the water. Sadly, in rock fishing, the most dangerous sport in Australia, if you do end up in the water, the outcome can be fatal. On the south coast of New South Wales, that's been the sad story of late. One of the lifesavers down that way, his name's Jared Kafe, He's a relative of Dogfish Dave, and he's decided to turn his life-saving talents and musical talents to the cause of saving rockfish's lives. Good morning, Jared.
Yeah, good day there, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to The Big Fish.
Lovely.
Now, this song we're going to play in just a moment, the Resus Rap, tell us a bit about your background in life-saving and how you came up with this. It's an earworm. Hopefully everyone will listen to it in the car on the way to the rock fishing spot this morning.
Well, I'll take that compliment any day. Being a bronze medallion trainer, which is the basic award for life-saving, naturally I've had to go through the process many times of resuscitation. And as a teacher, once you learn to teach something, it's got to be automatic. That's how I see it. Not to mention the number of times I've done this for my teaching career, because teachers have to do resuscitation every year now. And so it was so well built in my head that all the information was there, and coupled with a little bit of musical ability, it just tended to form. And it's a cultural piece, but it's also quite accurate. So the purists might argue, can we follow this from a first aid point of view? And I think you can. I think the information is quite accurate there to follow.
Music has been useful. You've taken that a step further.
Oh, sure. It's particularly some of the younger folk tuning into it, and I quite like that. I always try to offer something to the younger folk at the club, and if this sort of helps bring that message home a bit, then by all means, you know, sometimes they don't realise that being a first person at the scene of a first aid, even a young person, had a lot to offer. And I'll probably mention my incident where I actually did a resus on someone, a successful one, and it just gave me a huge boost in confidence. And I'm not bragging, but it really gives you a natural high when you find, gee, I can offer something to someone else through first aid.
Tell us about this resuscitation recently.
Well, it happened to be two old fishermen that had just retrieved their boat out of the water. And I was just walking through the parklands near the boat ramp to see a bit of commotion just around the back of the car that had just pulled their boat up. And when I went round there, although there were about 60 or 70 picnickers around there, all focused on this fella that was, by this stage he was down for the count, none of them had any first aid background. So I just stepped in and said, well, if no one else has any first aid background, well, I'll step in and I'll help. So it all swung in. He was still breathing, but reflecting on it, I suspect he was in what's called the fibrillation stage. He'd had his heart attack, and his heart now was just quivering and was ineffective. And while the phone was handed to me and I was in communication with the ambulance service, this guy's breathing just deteriorated to the point where he stopped, and he coloured up so dramatically in the face, purple. And it was no doubt he'd stopped breathing, and he needed resus. And so, to use an expression, he was kind of fresh, so he responded well, you know.
So
one set of compressions and a few sets of rescue breaths, and he came good, and he actually regained consciousness.
Wow.
And he wasn't in a good way, but he regained consciousness, and so when the ambulance did arrive, they downgraded their code to it's not life-threatening anymore. So, and they would know how to assess if somebody, you know, is
really...
Wow.
So you got that oxygen back to his brain and did the work of his heart, got it pumping again, and the colour came back a bit, did it?
Oh, yes.
And there's an old fisherman who's probably catching a few whiting down at Wanda Beach at the moment, saying that bloke up at the surf club looked after me.
Yeah, for sure, in my moment of need. And when I look back, it was relatively simple. And anyone can do a little bit of a sort of a confidence thing. I thought, gee, am I really going to start pressing on this guy's chest? And I thought, well, if I don't, he could struggle. He's only got 4 minutes before brain damage can start to occur once he stopped breathing. And so, like I said, being quite fresh, if I could use that expression, then the resus, that's probably why it was successful. But I think the guts of the song, if I can say it like that, is the DRSABCD. I'm not saying that we step around that. Yeah, we follow that for sure. And
just go through that for people who don't know what those initials stand for.
Sure. D for danger is when you approach someone, if you're unsure of how they got to be in their situation, the scenario we often use is just someone lying there, not moving, and we have no background as to how they got there. Then you've got to assess the danger because you could be putting yourself or bystanders in further danger if you make contact with the patient. And then R, once you check for danger, response of the patient. And we use a funny acronym, COWS. And it just means, can you hear me? Open your eyes. What's your name? And squeeze my hands. These are the sort of questions you sort of ask someone. And from that, you gauge their response and with it, their level of consciousness. S, you send for help. Don't leave them alone as such unless there is no other option, but you generally, you just don't leave the patient.
And it's one of the times when we never curse mobile phones, isn't it?
Oh, they are the most handy tool. They, you know, they are your best tool in some respects because there's the S for send for help. And if you do phone the ambulance, they'll keep the line open and continue asking you questions. So as in my situation, keep talking to them. And the only reason I had to hand the phone off from me to someone else is because I had to actually start.
Well, if you don't have someone there, put it on speaker, put it next to the patient and get stuck in. Look, let's get stuck into the song. Get down to your surf clubs or St. John Ambulance or whoever the training group is and get your bronze medallion. It really is a wonderful thing to do. And surf clubs are such welcoming places.
Oh, yeah.
As well. They look after everyone, regardless of their cultural background or gender or ability. It's just a fabulous community, really. And I know you love it there at Wanda. Wander down to Wanda. See Jared Cafe. Hey, and let's get into the song. I guess you're the new Ice Cube. Biggie Smalls of the Wanda Surf Club. Here it is.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for joining us on The Big Fish.
Righto.
Now if you have a choice between staying alive and another one bites the dust, you mean okay to give first aid, then these things are a must. If they're getting blue, then it's 30 to 2 and a third the depth of the chest. Then you give them plenty at 1 to 120. That's the rate you gotta compress. Here we go. 30 compressions and 2 breaths. 30 compressions and 2 breaths. Now DRSABCD is the best advice you'll get from me. They're down for the count horizontally, so it's DRSABCD. Now that is 30 compressions and 2 breaths. I say 30 compressions and 2 breaths. Now D for danger. First of all, to me. Then the people standing by. Then the patient, finally. R, response. Can you hear me? Cows. Open your eyes. What's your name? And squeeze my hands right now. S is send for help, but don't leave them alone. You could be the best chance they have of safely getting home. Are they good or are they not? Are they just taking a nap? You can get things sorted out when you do the recess rep. Here we go. Yeah, 30 compressions and 2 breaths. 30 compressions and 2 breaths. A for airway, check it's clear on their side or on their back. Cause if the airway isn't clear, they will have a heart attack. B for breath, it's critical that they get air down there. Cause if they don't get air down there, then there ain't much time to spare. Look for the rise and fall of the chest. Listen for the sound of them breathing. And feel their breath on your cheek. If their breathing's looking good, then place them in their crib. But if it's not, then it's CPR and time for the defib. Here we go! Yeah, give me those 30 compressions and 2 breaths. I said 30 compressions and 2 breaths. Place the pads correctly as shown in the picture. No one should touch the patient. Analyzing. Ensure that the ambulance service has been called. analyzer. Press the orange flashing button now. Hey, I'm back! Ooh, ain't it good to be alive?
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Morning, Stinker.
G'day, Scott.
Stinker, we're talking about experts, the expert fisher person this morning. The old saying that an expert is a form of drip under pressure.
Well, there's experts and experts in every field, isn't there? But in fishing, no one I know has got a real handle on it. Some have got a tighter grip than others, but really with fishing, we're just varying degrees of incompetency. That's how I see it. Some are less incompetent than others. But then there are anglers and there are danglers. And that's the way I see it. And really, danglers in most cases are quite happy to be danglers, whereas anglers in lots of cases want to be better. It's someone who, a golfer, who's forever trying to improve because they're never really satisfied. And the only way you can ever really defeat the game of golf, of course, is to have a hole in one on every single hole.
Yes.
And that's not going to happen.
No, perfection is unattainable.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. That made it much easier for me. Thank you for
that's
that.
All right, Stinker. That's all right. But you're gathering some of the experts for a new book project. Is it too early to mention that, or?
No, not really. I've written two previous fishing books going back to the mid-1990s, I think, was my first one, called Something Fishy. And it was a gathering of articles that I'd put in the local newspaper, because I've written 1,600 articles in the local newspaper and gathered some sensational fishing photos along the way, you can imagine. So that one really was great fun, and there was a market for it. People were interested in reading that. And so when they all went, I thought, well, I'll put another one out there. So a few years back, I put a book out called Fish Port Stevens. Well, that's gone too. And so I have none left. And I was just going to sort of pack my bags and head off over to Horizon. But then there's a demand for people who come to Port Stevens to find out what's going on around the place, whether you be an angler or a dangler. And so I thought, well, the best way of doing that is I'll write a significant amount of the books and put the book and put my stamp on it so people know that it's from me. But I've gone one step further and I've approached six of the very best fishermen in Port Stevens, and they are, they are less incompetent than most others. They are absolute champions.
I reckon you're a bit of an expert in your niche, though, which is light line bait fishing for snapper.
Oh, well, look, in my little corner of the world, which is in Stinkpot, in Fingal Bay, I mean, I know every rock and I know every fish by their first name. I mean, I'm very familiar here in this area, but where I differ from all the other guys is that you can find them on the continental shelf. You can find them fishing for game fish, or you might find them way up in the mangrove forests catching a bass, or up behind in the brackish and freshwater. They'll go everywhere from the feeder streams to the continental shelf. And they're there and about all the time. I mean, these guys are fanatical, really. But along the way, they have gathered incredible amount of knowledge. Yeah, incredible. And really, I wrote down what I thought a champion recreational fisher is. And that's someone who can target a species and go in and catch them on a regular basis. Now, it's not easy to target all the species that they target and to come home with success. It's not, the anglers can't do it.
But even that sorry. Philosophy of saying, right, today I'm going after flathead, or right, I'm going after bass, or I'm going after brim, that is something that a lot of danglers don't do either.
That's right. And that's the first mistake. That's their first mistake. And it was made very plain by one of the champs here, a fellow called Wayne Coles, who lives at Lemon Tree Passage. Now, Colesy is one of those that I mentioned, and that was his first point. He said, if you're going to prove to be a better fisherman, or you wish to improve your results, the best thing you do is target a species. And if you're fishing inside Port Stephens, that's whiting and brim and flathead. Now, you can branch out into all sorts of other things like mulloway, but let's leave mulloway until a bit further down the track. Concentrate on the bread and butter species, and once you feel you have some degree of success with those species, then you might be able to branch out into other ones that are a bit more difficult to catch. Oh, look, it all makes sense when you read it. It's all logical, but you need someone who's a very good fisher person to explain it in the simplest terms.
I think sometimes people just enjoy overcomplicating things too, and they love all of that nuance of it. The myriad of different lures to catch the fisher folk and all the rest, or it can be as simple as you want. It's a very all-encompassing pastime, isn't it? Anyone can have a crack at it.
Oh, look, and that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty. It doesn't matter whether you're one or 101. I mean, you can still have a shot. And basically, catching a fish or getting a bite, a nibble, is a real positive. It's the cream on the cake, basically. And the cake is the environmental experience, the time with the family, and just getting out and about. There is so much that besides fishing, catching fish is only a very small part of fishing, in my opinion. I mean, I just love to go out and enjoy the whales and the dolphins and all the other creatures that jump all over the top of me and fly over the top of me. And it's because it's just an experience. But it's interesting what you say, that their tackle box, you need a ladder to get into it. It's a giant thing. And if you use one lure for the rest of your life, one different lure, there'd still be a few over when you're done. There'd still be a few to go. And to take them with you every time you go is quite an extraordinary. But as you say, it attracts those people who are trying to find that secret. There's a secret to fishing, and if you could only find that secret, you'd be so much more successful. I mean, the golfers, here we go with the golfers again, because they're very, very similar. And I remember when a golf ball came out that had an extra dimple, one extra dimple, and someone, I think Greg Norman or someone like, said, if you hit this golf ball, it'll go 15 metres further because it's got this extra dimple. Well, they come from everywhere to buy this golf ball. And the same with coloured hooks. Oh, you had to have a red hook at one stage. If you didn't have a red hook, you waste your time going fishing. You see? And so, but we're suckers, really. When it all boils down, we'll fall for any trick in the book. When it all boils down, fishing's pretty simple. 50% fishing's simple. As a ex-sportsmaster, let me tell you that fishing's not hard. The hard part, which requires the skill that differentiates anglers from danglers, is the ability, the experience, and the knowledge to find out where the fish are in certain conditions. That's the trick.
Hey, speaking of school too, we're speaking with John Stinker-Clark, who was a sportsmaster at Port Stephens Nelson Bay High School. Young Paul Lennon went through your year and will he be in the book, do you think? I mean, has he got to the expert stage? Because I've seen photos of him that you've sent to me of flathead that look like crocodiles. Ridiculous.
Yeah, look, as Brent Hancock and Paul are both ex-students of mine, but I can tell you now, that I didn't teach them the skills that they've gathered since they left school. That's totally been there. They've gathered that themselves.
Did they ever whop it to go fishing?
Oh, look, if they did, I probably wouldn't have bothered
them. You would have encouraged them.
I probably would have thought I should have been there too.
Huckleberry Finn, great stuff. But did Paul have that, you know, great desire to fish when you were teaching him?
Ever since I've known him and Brent, they have just been folk as kids, and of course they're men in business now, and their business revolves around fishing. But when they were kids at school, that was all they focused upon. They weren't interested in anything else. All they wanted to do was get on the water and learn more about fishing and gather all the knowledge that's required. And the same, I had another family of Tarrants. Now, Tarrants are a very famous fishing family here in Port Stephens, and I knew as soon as these kids turned up at school, I knew what their future was, and they knew what their future was long before they walked into a classroom. And that is at 14 years and 9 months, or whatever the rule was those days, they'd be out of there in a hurry, and they'd be on a fishing boat with their grandfather to really learn how their life was going to unfold. So they spent most of their school life looking out the window. You know, what good is history? Teaching British history to a kid that's definitely going to be out there catching mullet on the beach.
That sort of knowledge that these fisher folk can bring to the scientific community, like Paul, is gold.
Well, they're the words I chose. I said, what these fellows are going to tell you is gold. So hinge on every word. But, and again, there's something else that really pleases me in this community, and I'm sure it's happening elsewhere, is the attitude of this younger generation that, like Brent and Paul, they let them go. I mean, that never happened when I was their age. We'd dong them on the head and throw them into the kitchen. And if your mother ever found out that you let a fish go that the family could eat, she'd dong you on the spot. It was a donging fest. But, yeah, no, look, the whole attitude has changed. And for the better. For the better. They are far more responsible. The younger generation are far, far more responsible than their fathers. And I am so pleased about that. Because I can see sustainability shining through. And that's a word that I use as often as I can when I'm speaking to kids. And I feature a lot of kids in my articles through the week. And the word sustainability features quite often. But this book I'm putting together, I'm tossing around a title. And listeners may even like to contribute. There you go. There's something I never thought about. Have a think. But the title I'm thinking of running with at the moment is Hang On. That's the title I'm thinking I might give this book. Because I don't know whether you noticed, but when I sort of speak about when you catch a fish and he takes off like the last bus, well, you say the best thing you can do is hang on.
That's right.
So that may well be the title of the book. But
are they
it's
getting
early days?
Yeah, well, people might want to come up with a working title as well. Are they getting any, mate?
What, here?
Yeah.
Or is that a title you're suggesting?
Well, both a question to you about the fishing at the moment, and also possibly a title idea, because that's part of your vernacular as well, isn't it?
It certainly is. Are you catching any, mate?
Yeah,
that's right. Well,
that's not a bad name. Not a bad name.
But to answer that question, the only action, the weather. Look, the worst thing a fisherman can do is continually, make excuses. But when you've got the inconsistency in the weather that we have been experiencing, particularly if you have 11-foot tinny that you wish to launch off the beach, and there's a 2 or a 3 metre swell. Well, 2 metres not too bad, but 3 metre swell or anything over 2 metres gets a little bit uncomfortable, and it makes me think twice. It didn't used to, but it does now. And so that sort of restricts my time on the water. But luckily, we live in Port Stephens, so you look inside the port. Well, all I can say, we're having one of the best dusky flathead seasons that we've had. And Mulloway, up around the bridges at Karua, and you're familiar with that area. There are two bridges now, Karua. There only used to be one, but now there's two.
Yeah, the new one.
I was asking Georgie Trinkler, who's another one in my of the Magnificent Six. That reminds me. Did you ever see that movie, The Magnificent Seven?
I did. Yes, it had.
How many times?
Seven? No, a couple of times.
Well, that's a bit like my book. But anyway, so George says that, and he's a master up there and everywhere else, another master fisherman. And he tells me that the Mulloway underneath the bridges, I mean, gee willikers, it's just fantastic, really. This place never ceases to amaze me. I've been here nearly 50 years. And I'm not over it by a long shot. It still amazes me, and the stories I get, and I think I know what I'm talking about until someone contacts me and says that there's a marlin just jumped up on the breakwater in Nelson Bay.
That's right. That was the story the other day. It was true. Absolutely true.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
So, you know, I used to sort of scratch my head and think, oh, no, that can't be true. But the fact of the matter is you've got to take everything into account these days.
Yeah, it's good to have all of those people out there as your eyes and ears as well. And if it is the Magnificent Six, then maybe you could play Yul Brynner's part or Steve McQueen.
That's probably the one for me.
You
share a similar hairstyle.
Hey, yeah. Great to talk to you again, John.
All the best, Scott. Hooroo.
John Stinker Clark, The Big Fish.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Craig McGill's on Sydney Harbour for the next cast. What's happening there at the moment, Craig? Give us a commentary.
Oh, mate, it's all happening here. We just had a sea turtle circling the boat, and as we're doing that, I've just hooked a squid at the same time.
And you're doing a cross with me, and you've handed the rod over to one of your clients.
Yeah, this turtle, there he is again. He's under the boat now, and he's just cruising around the boat. I've never seen one do that before.
He wants to eat your squid.
I think he does.
Wow, that'd be a sight. Look, well, give us a live description of the action as it unfolds, Craig.
So we're just off Lady Jane Beach, literally within casting distance, and there's this green, I think it's a green turtle. That's the common one that you get up north, isn't it?
The green sea turtle.
Yeah. And he's just swimming around the boat, which normally they spook as soon as they see you and they dive down, but this one's just cruising around the boat. I don't know what he's doing. And the boys have just, I hooked a squid while we were drifting along and just hauling that one in as well. But the water temperature, I can tell you, we've got, 24.5 degrees on the sounder here. So it's unbelievably warm. Ah, it's not a squid, it's an octopus. It's a big, ugly octopus.
Oh, no.
And he's just let his ink go.
Oh, not hopefully not all over you and the phone.
Let him go, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's unbelievable, isn't it? Sydney Harbour, what an amazing spot.
Wow, that's exciting, isn't it?
A
big octopus. If you had any Greek fisher people on board, they wouldn't be letting you let it go.
Oh, well, he'd be beaten on the hot driveway 100 times, isn't that the saying?
Or it's a cement mixer.
They do that at the markets, and they put some river pebbles in there. Although I've got a theory about that, right? My personal opinion is that anything that you've got to beat on the driveway 100 times or roll in a cement mixer with pebbles, is it really food? I mean, if somebody gave you a bit of meat, you know, a bit of beef and said, okay, oh, just by the way, before you eat this, you've got to put it in a cement mixer and roll it for half an hour with river pebbles, you'd have your doubts about it, wouldn't you?
And by the sound of it, Sydney Harbour's octopus are safe with you, Craig McGill.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I have tried to cook them before, and it's been a failure pretty much every time.
Look, I think we were talking about squid last week on the program, and I got some lovely Broken Bay squid. They were the arrow squid. I don't know the exact. And just so nice, fresh, just cut into rings, skin taken off, and just flash fried. You put the oil in the wok, you put it in, you take it out. That's it.
Oh, mate, they're just so good, and there's nothing like it. You can't match that in the shops, just bringing it straight home and straight into the pan, that sweetness and that crunch that they've got. And everybody talks about having to tenderise them with, you know, kiwi fruit and milk and all this sort of thing. If you get them fresh and cook them properly, you don't have to do any of that.
Well, it's just at the time you cook them. And you know what I did this time? Because they were so fresh, as you say, and they're easy to catch, those ones too. They hang on to anything. You don't even need a squid jig to catch those. They'll hang on to your bait, those arrow squid. They're so aggressive. And they were nice ones, about 30 centimetres long. But I took a ring and I actually ate it raw. and it was as sweet as honey.
Oh, mate, absolutely. I love sashimi squid. In fact, one of my favourite meals ever is a dish that the Japanese do called ika natto. Ika is squid, and natto is a fermented soybean that they do, and it's raw squid, and you mix it together, and it's just unbelievable. Different, but maybe not everybody's cup of tea, but yeah, raw squid, absolutely delicious.
Is the sea turtle still there?
No, I can't. He seems to have gone, but it was very unusual. I've never seen them just circle the boat like that. Normally, as soon as they see you, they're straight out of there.
A big one?
Yeah, he was probably half a metre across, I guess.
Yeah, nice. They're beautiful animals. And he looked looked healthy, because the plastic bags are a problem with them, aren't they? You know, getting the plastic out of the ocean's a big thing to save them.
Yeah, no, he looked fine. He had, you know, he was quite bright. His shell was colourful and he looked in good condition.
Nice.
But talking squid, the squid have absolutely come on fire in the harbour over the last couple of weeks. I normally find this time of year, autumn, you know, to be good. And with them has come the kingies. So we got a metre kingie this week out at North Head and a couple up around the 90s, up around the eastern suburbs. So always happening here. This is my favourite time of year. I love this time now. Autumn from, you know, March, April, May, I think is probably the best time of year for fishing. And for mixed bags too, not just kingies. We get our dewies now, our big flathead, your brim, anything really. It's just a great time of year.
Marvellous. And those squid are so good. They're too good sometimes to put out as a kingfish bait, but they are the secret, aren't they? They really are. 24-degree water too. That's great. And are they the big calamari squid?
Yep. Whopping big ones. Yep. Aircraft carriers, we call them.
That's great, isn't it?
You could land on their back.
Surely you could put the nice big head on with the ink sac and then keep some of the mantle to beat?
Well, that's what I do. So the head and the guts are the best bait. And these have been big enough that the head, you know, you can split in half. So you're getting three baits before you even have to touch the mantle. So, yeah, often lately we've been taking home a feed of squid and had plenty enough for bait as well.
Brilliant stuff. And what about the crew on board today? Are they having a bit of fun?
Yep, absolutely, mate. Yep, it's been good. The whole week's been good. Finally, we're starting to see a bit of decent weather too.
And where are you out towards the heads today?
Yep, just off Lady Jane at the moment. We'll probably go and try inside North Head, and we'll probably try sort of Vaucluse, Watson's Bay area. That seems to have been the best spot lately.
Nice area. Remember, we were out that day and a bloke in a kayak hooked a very big kingie just near Watson's Bay. I think it was near that marker buoy, the really nice-looking marker buoy. What's it called? The wedding cake or something?
That's right. And it towed him all over the shop.
He was water skiing. He was water skiing. Oh, it's a great harbour. Another great thing about Sydney Harbour is that the witches' hats, which kill the turtles and ghost fish, are banned.
Yes,
and
that's right.
That's a wonderful thing. They should be banned in all waters, according to Stinker on the program. And they're banned in Nelson Bay now. They use dilly pots, and they're a real killer of turtles in Lake Macquarie and the places where they're still allowed, but not allowed in Sydney Harbour, which I think is a good thing, don't you?
Yeah, look, I tend to think so. I mean, you know, I used to use them in the old days, and you'd pull up all sorts of things. You'd have Port Jackson sharks stuck in there, and then once you lose one, you know, assuming that the float's still on the top of it, it's going to go on killing even after, you know, until it rots away, which is going to be a long time for nylon.
Yeah, they ghost fish. But the dilly pot was an alternative, because when it's on the bottom, it doesn't hurt anything if you did lose it. And I guess there's so much traffic in Sydney Harbour as well. You don't need too many extra boys out there, do you?
That's right, too. And I think even, you know, they probably should look at some law for some sort of, like they do on some of the commercial traps, where if they do lose the trap, it's got the lock that keeps the door shut. It's like a biodegradable thing. So eventually it just opens up.
That's a good idea. That's a very good initiative. Now, what's the activity like on Lady Jane Beach? Are you close in? Can you see are people having a good time?
Pretty quiet at the moment. Pretty quiet at the moment, but I'm sure that it'll pick up later on, yeah.
All right. It's clothes optional, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't even know if it's optional anymore, is it? I think it's gear off these days.
Yeah, well, fair enough. When in Rome, that's all.
Exactly.
It's a beautiful day. It's absolutely beautiful. So, anyway, you're there for fishing.
Hopefully nobody's going to nude up on this boat today.
Right. Watch those hooks.
Yeah.
Tight lines, Craig McGill.
All right, mate. Talk soon.
Catch you next week on The Big Fish. Don't forget, too, you can catch us on the podcast at your leisure. And you can also send us a fishy photo, or drop us a line, thebigfish@your.abc.net.au.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.